Welcome everybody to the first sales lunchtime seminar of 2012. I've got the great pleasure of introducing Nicolas de Sadler, who's a leading EU and international environmental lawyer. He is Jean Monnet Professor of EU Law at St. Louis University in Brussels. He also teaches at the Louvain Academy and is a visiting professor at the University of Lund and the University of Louvain. He's also the author of one of my personal favorite books, Environmental Principles, From Political Slogans to Legal Rules, which really covers EU environmental law from a very comparative perspective with other systems, and is unfortunately published with Oxford University Press. But Nicolas combines legal scholarship with practical experience. He just finished a very comprehensive study for the European Commission on NGOs and environmental groups' access to justice. And I think today he will share with us some of his thoughts on protection against acts adopted by EU institutions and likely to harm the environment. So welcome with me, Professor de Sadler.
Hello. Thank you for the Cambridge invitation to hold this conference. The title of my conference is Protection Against Acts Adopted by the EU Institutions Likely to Harm the Environment, Acts are Likely to be Challenged by Private Parties. Against this background, I won't touch upon the issue of litigations taking within the realm of EU secondary law taken by private parties before national court. So my speech is rather narrow as regards standing of individuals or NGOs before the general court or the court of justice. Second, I will follow a two-pronged approach. On one hand, addressing the classical issue of the standing for action for annulment with respect to the former case law of the European Court of Justice, and what's the added value of the new paragraph 4 of Article 263, which has already been docked within much academic controversies. Second, I will broadly speaking skim over a very specific action for internal review that has been provided for by 2006 European Parliament and Council regulation applying the Convention of Aarhus regarding the access to justice, participation, making process, and access to information. And on the basis of these two critical analyses, we will try to put forward some critical ideas as to how to improve standings of individuals. Well, as a starting point, I would like to stress that public policy cannot provide any added value to citizens or to the environment in as much it is not correctly applied, implemented. And this remark is particularly salient with regard to environmental law. Environmental law has been criticized for over the years for failing its mission to increase, to enhance the level of environmental protection on the account that it appears as tigre de papier, paper tiger, toothless, on the account that the administrations are not equipped to apply correctly the environmental rules, or the administrations are unwilling, or the administration are subject to this phenomena described by the American political scientists as agency capture, lobbyists do prevail over administrative choices and dictate the administration regularly to keep a low profile in striking a balance between the various interests. And so as a result, though environmental law has been under development for nearly half a century so far, we are facing a major environmental crisis. Just open any newspaper, be it in North America, be it in Europe, be it in Spain, be it in the UK, you will realize quickly that's not only an issue of nanotechnology, it's not only an issue of climate change, it's not only an issue of waste disposal. We do face major issues. Even countries like Germany, who has been really making headway for 20, 30 years in developing new technologies to abate pollution, even countries like Germany has been discovering recently that a number of hazardous waste is being discarded illegally on the eastern part of the country. So the member state with the best environmental record in the EU is still discovering after 30 years of smart policy that the rules are not applied. And so that raises a question: how can we improve the correct implementation of rules that are probably providing for a good answer to the problems we are facing? And that raises the questions whether third parties are able to challenge the omissions of the administration, the reluctance of the administration, or even the dirty tricks of some of the administration in enacting decrees that do depart from general legislation heading for a greater environmental protection level. And so from the studies I carried out, or my different colleagues carried out for public institutions in Europe, it appears that environmental law will remain toothless unless third parties have a better chance to control the ways in which administration intervenes in conceiving and in applying the different rules. Standing conditions in the EU, which had to be met by individual applicants prior to the Lisbon Treaty, had a chilling effect on a great deal of potential applicants seeking to challenge directives, regulations, decisions likely to impair the quality of the environment. And you are aware that under a former Article 230, paragraph 4 of the EC Treaty, then non-privileged claimants had to demonstrate that they were directly and individually affected by the Challenge Act, conditions that usually have never been fulfilled in cases related to the implementation of environmental law. In particular, I can imagine if you have been attending classes on procedural issues within the EU legal order, that you're aware of the 1963 case Plowman, in which the Court of Justice held that if the applicant was not the addressee of the decision whose annulment is sought, he must show that he is individually concerned. And this will only be the case if the decision or the regulation affects the applicant by reason of certain attributes which are peculiar to them, to it, or by reason of circumstances in which they are differentiated from all other persons. And so that case law developed in 1963 has is completely unfit to address the issue of applicants standing to protect collective goods on the account that the victims of pollution, the NGOs seeking a higher level of environmental protection, are not fulfilling that condition. They by no means can differentiate themselves from other persons, other citizens likely to be a victim of hazard or victim to pollution. So just to mention a case in point is a case that was adjudicated first by the General Court and second by the Court of Justice, a Greenpeace case. Was quite similar to the reasoning endorsed by the Court of Justice in the Unión de Pequeños Agricultores case that was adjudicated in 2002. Greenpeace, with a number of inhabitants of the Canary Islands, the Kingdom of Spain, challenged the decision of the Commission to grant the Canary Islands regional authorities a substantial amount of money, 12 million euros, to build a high electricity generator using coal technology. Greenpeace challenged on the merits that this support, financial support given to old-fashioned technology was not consistent with the treaty requirement according to which environmental concerns should be integrated into the different policy, among which the energy policy. And the answer of both courts was that nothing differentiated Greenpeace and the other individuals living nearby the power station from all the other inhabitants or all the other NGOs or all the other associations of the islands. And so the Plowman decision could not be met. The second condition, the questions of whether the applicants is directly affected is not or was not easily fulfilled. And there is another case in point I should mention. It's the Statel case that was adjudicated by the Court of Justice. It was a preliminary reference sent by a Finnish administrative court. And the case is fairly easy. You had a number of Finnish forest owners and Finnish operators producing wood that were likely to be subject to nature conservancy obligations stemming from the Natura 2000 directive, now directive 9243. And as you are perhaps aware, if you are coming from countries with a number of nature conservancy potential, that directive obliged member states to protect swathes of lines in the territory according to scientific criteria. The procedure is that is really heavily influenced by the principle of subsidiarity. On the one hand, the Commission has to enact decision identifying the mountains, the coastline, the bogs, the heathland, which are likely to be subject to protection. And that's needed because one cannot protect exclusively the nature in England without thinking about what needs to be protected in Wales or in England. If one lives in Belgium, one realizes that the birds wintering on the west side of the Scheldt do spend most of the time also on the eastern side of the Scheldt in Flanders. And so the Commission has been enacting a number of decisions regarding not member states, but broad biogeographical regions, among which the Burrell region, encompassing most of Sweden, most of Lithuania and Latvia, and also Finland. And so the owners of plots of lands in Finland discovered, in reading the official journal, that their forests were falling within the ambit of the areas subject to the obligations of protection laid down under the directive. And so they challenged this decision, and there was a preliminary reference sent to the court. Advocate General Bott considered that the parties, the applicants, were directly concerned by the Commission decision, and they were fulfilling the second conditions laid down under paragraph 4. The problem was that, on the other hand, the Commission is unable to determine the level of protection for every marshland, every coastline, every range of mountain range in Europe. These much more precise regulations don't need to be discussed or enacted in Brussels. According to the present principle of subsidiarity, they must determine at local, regional, or national level. And so the Court of Justice departed from the opinion of Advocate General Yves Bot in holding that the applicants were not directly impacted by the decision provided, in as much as the Finnish authorities did still have to enact national decrees determining the level of protection, and as a result, constraining the possibilities to operate. And so these two cases, Greenpeace and Statels, are good case in point, because it provides you insights as to the difficulties for landowners, for NGOs, to challenge EU regulations, EU decisions, or EU directive. So in order to challenge a regulation, the applicants will have to breach the national criminal provisions on the account that a regulation cannot be implemented into national law. So there is this need to breach the national criminal provision resulting from the regulation, in the hope that the national criminal court will be willing to send a preliminary reference to the Court of Justice in Luxembourg, pursuant to Article 267. And that raises, as a matter of course, a fundamental problem. Is it possible to require individuals or associations of individuals to breach the law in order to gain access to justice? The answer of the Human Court, or the Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, is clearly no. The situation is hardly any better where directives are concerned. Neither the condition that the applicant is directly concerned, nor the individuality test stemming from the Plowman case law will be met. As a result, applicants have to challenge not the directive before the General Court or wherever, but they have to challenge the implementing measures with the hope again that they will that the National Court will send a reference for a preliminary ruling. As a matter of fact, courts, but the Supreme Court, are not obliged, according to treaty rules, to send a reference for a preliminary ruling. And though Supreme Courts are called on to send a preliminary ruling, there is still the théorie de l'acte clair, stemming from the Silfit case law, that allows General Court to depart from that obligation. And as a result, a reference for a preliminary ruling does not compensate for the strict case law regarding standing rights of NGOs or individuals to challenge directly the acts of the Commission or the other institution, the omissions or the decisions of these institutions. And so Article 230, paragraph 4, has been far from offering an actio popularis, and let alone just the possibility to challenge decision endorsed at EU level. Within the ORIS Convention on Access to Justice and Participation and Access to Information with regard to environmental issues, a number of NGOs, about 30 among which World Wildlife Fund and the Eco Institute in Germany, brought proceedings before the Compliance Committee in Geneva, set up by that convention. And on the 14th of March of last year, that Compliance Committee, which is composed of a number of international law professors, held that it was clear that the case law of the Court of Justice was too strict to meet the criteria of the Aarhus Convention that is aiming at not opening the floodgates for litigation, but at least at improving the conditions under which individuals and NGOs can initiate proceedings against administration. So the questions we are dealing in our paper is whether the Court of Justice would be able to revise its restrictive reading of standing rules while keeping them within the parameters of its judicial prerogatives, while still abiding by the conditions laid down by the framers of the treaty. In that respect, it's of interest to have a look at the Aarhus Compliance Committee decision of the 14th of March, according to which the provisions of the treaty on which the Court of Justice has been based its strict position is drafted in open textured terms that could be interpreted so as to provide standing for qualified individuals and civil society organizations in such a way that the standards laid down under the Aarhus Convention could be met. So that the question has been discussed at length in several circles in Brussels is whether the new paragraph 4 of not Article 230 but 236 will radically change the situation with regard to these challenges, in particular with respect to the to environmental issues. Whereas former Article 230, paragraph 4, only provided for two situations, the question of challenging a decision that was directly addressed to the addressee, and the possibility to challenge a false decision like a regulation inasmuch as the applicant was fulfilling the Plowman test and the directly affected text, has been radically modified on the account that the new paragraph includes a third possibility. So according to the first possibility, natural or legal persons initiate proceeding against an act addressed to that person. It will be the case of an undertaking like Solvay that's going to contend or that's going to challenge a decision enacted by the Commission on the account that the company has been infringing Article 102 on monopoly, on abuse of monopoly. The decision of the Commission is directly addressed to Solvay. So there is going to fulfill that first possibility. The second possibility is just the hypothesis I've been discussing at length, under which the two conditions have to be met, irrespective of whether the act being challenged has been addressed to the applicant. And what's new under the sun is the third possibility that has been that was enacted in the former constitution and that has been recopied within the Treaty of Lisbon, related to the possibility for natural or legal persons to initiate proceeding against a regulatory act which is of direct concern. So the issue, the condition of directing, impacting the applicant legal situation remains, and that does not entail any implementing measure. So the drafters of the new paragraph 4, in requiring that at least three conditions are met, the act must be of regulatory nature, the applicant must be directly affected by the challenge act, and thirdly, that the act should not entail implementing measure, have been striking to seek to obtain a compromise to strike a balance between, on the one hand, the desire to expand standing, but on the other hand, not to open up the floodgates to litigation, on the account that the Court of Justice is extremely aware that the number of cases brought, in particular before the General Court, is just on the increase, continuously into an increase, and the Court of Justice wants to keep a high level of quality as regards its case law. And they are not ready to take up 200, 300 new cases dealing with natural resources every year. So, though the provision is really aiming at improving the situation of litigants, in particular in getting rid of the conditions that was discussed in, at length in Unidos de Pequeños Agricultores, or the Greenpeace case I mentioned, still require that the applicants fulfill a number of conditions. So in the literature so far, the issue of regulatory act has been discussed at length, probably on the account that the other provisions of the treaty are not referring to the issue of regulatory act, that category of act, unlike delegated act or unlike executive act, is not defined elsewhere, neither in the Treaty on the Union nor in the Treaty on the Functioning. And so, while the drafters of the Lisbon Treaty provided for that condition, well, this is explained by the history, the chaotic history of the Lisbon Treaty. That provision was drafted within La Constituante in Brussels under the mandate of of Laeken, and as a matter of crisis, the drafter of the Lisbon Treaty just picked up the former provision drafted by the Constituent, and they recopied word by word without understanding, or without really understanding the extent to which the interpretation of that category or act will be dug in controversies. So there are two opposing views so far in the literature. One view argues that regulatory act only includes non-legislative acts, and hence mostly delegated or implementing act pursuant to Article 290 and 291. Three arguments are usually put forward. This argument appears to be confirmed by the framers of the now defunct constitution. So during the debate in the course of drafting of the former provision, the views endorsed by the negotiator was to discard from the new standing conditions legislative act. This view is also supported by a number of academics who consider that individuals should not challenge vested acts with a certain democratic legitimacy. In case the Commission enact implementing measures or enact delegate measures, the Commission is not a legislative representative body. So most of the academics are taking the view that the Commission should be under greater scrutiny than the European Parliament and the Council when the Council acts as a lawmaker. And so non-legislative acts taken by non-representative bodies, institutions, should be the subject to greater scrutiny than a framework directive or framework regulation. Thirdly, this position has been recently confirmed in the order of the General Court of the 6th September 2011 that is dealing with a challenge abroad initiated by Inuits from Greenland. According to an opposing view, which has been defended among other scholars by Koen Leenaerts, who is prisoner for the third chamber in Luxembourg, The regulatory act category covers any acts with a general scope which produce binding effects irrespective of whether the act concerned is legislative or not. But this second interpretation, as a matter of fact, is broader, is much more favorable to the litigants. This second interpretation is based on the fact that in a considerable number of constitutional order, legislative acts may be challenged before the Supreme Court or the Constitutional Court without any requirement for the applicants to demonstrate that they are individually affected. Thirdly, or the third argument put forward, is that the determination of what's legislative at EU level is not rocket science, is not exact science, given that you have two categories of legislative acts, the acts enacted according to the ordinary legislative procedure, and on the other hand, the legislative act enacted pursuant to the special legislative procedure. But the legislative procedure, the special legislative procedure, is not so as democratic from a national point of view than the ordinary legislative procedure. The parliament is just delivering an opinion to the council. So the role of the parliament is completely belittled. And so the argument put forward by many academics could be also contradicted. So what's the view of the General Court in that order of the 6th of September 2011, order that subject to an appeal to, before the Court of Justice? So in brief, a number of hunters from Greenland, native hunters, as well as trading associations who specialize in trading in seal products, challenged the regulation of the European Parliament and the Council of 2009 restricting within the EU trade in seal products. So of course, the scope of the regulation is not to encompass the seals products being placed on the market in Greenland or in Canada. It's just to limit the import, or to restrict the import of sealed products within the EU. Of course, as a matter of fact, that regulation is impinging upon the trading interest of the litigants. So the European Commission, the lawyers of the Parliament, the Commission, and the Council, contented with the fact that the applicants were fulfilling the new conditions, and primarily they argued that the framework regulation was deemed to be a legislative act, falling out with the scope of regulatory act. And as a result, applicants were obliged to fulfill the two classical conditions, the Plowman test on one hand, and the direct applicability test on the other hand. So the General Court highlights that one should distinguish between two situations, a challenge brought against a legislative or regulatory act of general application, which is of direct and individual concern to them, so nothing new under the sun, and so that's not very helpful for applicants wishing to protect the environment. And secondly, the challenge brought against certain acts of general applications, namely regulatory acts, which are of direct concern to them and do not entail implementing measures. And so, accordingly, the purpose of the new paragraph 4 is to allow a natural or legal person to institute proceedings, thereby avoiding the situation in which such a person would have to infringe the law to have access to the court. So the General Court is taking the view that the new provision, the new paragraph, has been drafted in such a way to circumvent the hurdles stemming from the classical Unión de Pequeños Agricultores case law. But, as a matter of law, only certain acts of general applications are deemed to be regulatory acts. And it follows that legislative acts are not considered for, according to historical interpretation, to teleological interpretation, as well as to textual interpretation, legislative acts cannot be subject to an action for annulment by natural persons just fulfilling the new conditions. The individual will have still to comply with the two traditional conditions. As regards the questions whether the applicants, the Inuit applicants, were directly affected by the measure at issue, the court, the general court, took the view that the trading associations were directly impinged upon by the prohibition of selling their products. Well, the trading possibilities within the EU were restricted, whereas the General Court endorsed another approach with respect to the hunters. The General Court took the view that the hunters could still hunt the seals, they could still consume the seals within Greenland, or they could even still export them to Canada. So, but that order is being appealed, and so the Grand Chamber of the Court of Justice will have to adjudicate this case, and I can imagine there will be in the future some dissenting views within the Grand Chamber. Lately, the General Court adjudicate case Microban dealing with food safety issue. The case is much easier to understand. It's just the second case regarding the application of the new paragraph 4. In that case, a decision of the commission listing or delisting an antimicrobial substance from a positive list of chemical substances in food processes was challenged by the companies producing or placing on the market that substance. And as a matter of course, the General Court held that the decision fell within the scope of the notion of non-regulatory act. The General Court mainly referred to the reasoning followed in the Inuit case, according to which a regulatory act within the meaning of the new provision has to be construed as covering all acts of general application but the legislative acts. So there is a sharp dividing line. Though the applicants will challenge decision or regulation, they will still have to demonstrate that the second condition is fulfilled, is that the contested act does not require any implementing measure. In our paper, we identify three different hypotheses. The first hypothesis is that the act entails a national implementing measure. So that will be the decision in this boreal biogeographical area under which most of the forest in the wild forest in Finland should be subject of certain level of protection. But the precise level of protection has to be determined later on by the national authorities. And so exclusively national Finnish decision would have to be challenged before the National Council of State, also with the hope that the Council of State will refer questions for permanent ruling to Luxembourg. So that case is fairly to understand. Most of the environmental regulation at EU level is composed of directives. So all the directives entail implementing measures. So the bulk of environmental law will fall within this first category, and it will be just impossible for private parties to challenge this directive. So there is nothing new. Second hypothesis is that the Act entails an EU implementing measure. So you do have a framework regulation that's been followed up by Commission regulations providing for the positive list, providing for the authorization scheme, setting up the number of quotas, giving all the details. Well, in that case, as a matter of fact, the litigants, person to the new condition, will have to challenge the decisions or the regulations adopted by the Commission. They won't be able to challenge, under the new standing conditions, the framework regulations. That won't make any sense. And so, given that the whole environmental process is a kind of stage-by-stage process, it's fairly long and awkward, complex, according to which first the kind of framework obligations are laid on, and they are followed up by much more precise obligations enacted by a government or by the Commission. So again, the litigants will have to wait for the enactment, the adoption or the publication in the official journal of the Commission regulations. So, and that they won't be able to contend immediately the framework regulation. So there is not so much change in that respect. Well, the third hypothesis should be the most favorable, is that supposedly the Regulatory Act does not entail any implementing measure at EU level. But in skimming over many regulations, things are far from being obvious. Often you do have provisions that are likely to entail the possibility for the Commission to intervene. And so one is never sure whether the Commission is going to enact guidelines, communication, even regulations or decisions within the framework of this more general obligation. And so that raises the questions whether the Challenge Act is not likely to be followed by more precise decisions later on. And so how to interpret the term entail, since this word embraced the concept of admit, of contain, and so we can develop different reasoning according to the German language, to the Latvian language, to according to each of the 21 or 22 national languages. So one can see that though there was a certain willingness at the level of the constituent to improve the standing of private parties, the private parties may still have to overcome a number of hurdles. With respect to the implementation of this Aarhus Convention, the Commission realized that there was a need also to allow faster proceedings, allow parties to seek the review internally of a number of decisions. And so with a view to implementing the International Convention within the EU legal order, the Parliament and the Council enacted the Aarhus Regulation in 2006 that provide for a two-stage right of access to justice. First, the applicant, the NGO, is going to seek for an internal review of the administrative act before either the Council or either the Commission. And second, when that review will lead to insatisfactory result, deregulation provides for the possibility for the latter to apply to the Court of Justice. The regulation is fairly complex and has been subject to much criticism from a number of authors who are taking the view that the regulation insufficiently is fleshing out the obligations laid down in the Aarhus Convention. So I will just briefly put forward some comments as regards the personal scope, the material scope, and the standards for review. But at the outset, I should mention that so far, in somewhat 6 or 5 years of existence, only 8 proceedings have been brought, 7 of them before the Commission, 1 before the Council of Ministers, which is extremely little. If I read European Voice in Brussels, I have at least 3 pages of a 25 page on nature resource management and environmental and climate change issues. And you have hundreds, thousands of lobbyists being busy with that topics from day and night in Brussels. Just 8 challenges. So it's really extremely little in compared to this very brutal political debate we do have. And all these challenges were deemed by the Commission and Council to be inadmissible. So the regulation does not provide for any improvement as regards the NGOs. So who can bring the action for internal reviews, NGOs exclusively, against which public body? And there the regulation is quite generous because it provides that the internal review process could be initiated before either an agency or either an institution. But there are a number of exceptions that are provided. The Commission is not subject to the internal review process with respect to its powers within the competition regulatory provisions, with respect to its infringement proceedings, with respect to ombudsman proceedings, and also with respect to the OLAF proceedings. So a number of areas of law escape the internal review. As regards the material scope, the scope is extremely narrow. There must be a contest act, but that act should have legally binding effects, which is not the case of communications or guidelines, but we are still very politically salient. And these acts must be on not only internal acts, but they should be have external effects. And finally, the act has to be individual and adopted under environmental law. So all the regulatory acts are falling out with the scope of ambit of that regulation. So that means only very specific individual decisions are likely to be subject to be challenged, to challenge. The proceeding before the Court of Justice is much easier, but it's not the Commission Act that's or the Council Act that's going to be challenged. It will be the refusal of the Commission or the Council that will be likely to challenge. And so the Court of Justice cannot really rule on the merits whether the contended act is likely to depart from the treaty obligation. So, as a in brief, we understand that on the one hand, from a European perspective, the Aarhus Convention is deemed to be a major step forward regarding the crucial issue of effective enforcement within the field of environmental policy. But on the other hand, the decentralized model of access to justice based on the principle of subsidiarity, according to which national courts do play a key role, is enabled to defend the rights of individuals, in particular NGOs, to challenge a number of key legal acts or regulatory acts that really impinging upon our quality of life. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.